We recap a fun night of NBA basketball on Thursday. Where the hell do the Lakers go from here? And we check in on teams that will be active on the trade market. That and more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome to a special Friday edition of No Cap Room here on the Ball Don't Lie podcast network. My name is Jake Fisher. I am a senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. And joining me as always, back in the chair, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports. It is my man. It is your man. It is everyone's man, Dan Devine. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing great, man. New year, new me, slicked back hair, pushed back hair, sloppy steaks at Trufoni's. We're trying to shift my sleeping schedule. So instead of being tired from staying up too late, we're getting tired from getting up too early. We're trying to work it all out, watch a ton of basketball, write about it, and then talk about it and here with you. So I'm excited about it. I heard you were talking a gang of shit about me on No Cap Room last week while I was absent. I'm here to set the record straight and set you straight, but we're going to do that over the course of the next hour or so.
All right, let's get into it then, because we had two good games last night. Bucks Spurs 125-121. I was going to pause to allow you to talk, so let's get into it. Giannis versus Wemby was fun as hell. Giannis's final stat line: 44 points, 14 rebounds, 7 assists, 2 steals, 1 block. Wemby 27-9. One assist, one steal, 5 blocks. Still on a minutes restriction after an ankle turn, after several ankle turns. When the first ankle turn, he didn't feel because he was built like a cyborg. So, I don't know. This was a game, I think, that really showed what this dude is capable of and kind of was a reminder to any haters who have thought, all right, the wins aren't there. Chet Holmgren's doing his thing in OKC. I saw some meme on Twitter about Victor should wear the Donovan Mitchell rookie definition Adidas shirt from a couple years ago. But I think, you know, this is more about just like Victor looking at potentially what his future could be and maybe even exceeding that. Dan, what was your kind of takeaway from this clash on TNT?
Well, my first one is that if he does that, if Victor does do that, I want to see just him taking the one from Donovan Mitchell. I want to see if it comes up to like the middle of his forearm. My first thought was like, I think of this less as like thinking that what Chet's doing is cool equals hating on Wembanyama, but it was a very cool reminder of you're absolutely right. Like the, not just what he is capable of already, but like you start dream casting and wishing into the future. The photograph from, the San Antonio Express News of the block that Victor had on Giannis at the rim from the final minute of the game. His entire hand is around the ball. Like Giannis is trying to dunk through him. Giannis dunks through everybody. And he got his entire palm on the ball and just took it down. Like every, you know, we are getting used to saying that this guy's an alien and that this guy does things that no one's ever seen. Like that's something I've never seen. I was like, and it was like wholly unbelievable to see in real time. And then to go back and look at the still shot of it. It's also just funny. Like, even Greg Popovich, famously like grumpy and taciturn and whatever else, Greg Popovich, he's kind of just like, I don't know, like maybe he can go win it by himself. Maybe maybe I like everything that I just saw. I have no notes on what I just saw. He's getting to a point where Victor Wembanyama checked himself back into the game, like minutes restriction against Memphis the other night, walked past Pop because he was like, I already played 25 minutes. What's two more? Like, I think any other situation you'd be like, oh man, is that like a trouble in paradise type deal? And no, everyone's just kind of like, yes, get him on the floor more. And Pop's like, yeah, I don't know. What are you going to do? Like, it's just, it was absolutely, he is an experience. And then seeing like, when you wonder why, as you get this deep into a season, why like a 5-win team is still getting national TV showcases, wonder no longer. There's that. And for the Bucks to, you know, withstand that, for Giannis, who is playing, you know, maybe some of the, he's consistently elite no matter what, but he's playing some of the best basketball of his career right now, sort of quiet as it's kept, for them to withstand that, for them to move on, get the win on the road, second night of a back-to-back after a couple of rocky games. Like, it was a good win for them, but it's also the kind of good loss that San Antonio was hoping to stack more and more of this season.
The other young prospects with length and theoretical upside on San Antonio haven't been as charming, to say the least, this season. And I feel like, I mean, Dan, you were like grumpy old man on the couch, like with your beer pointing at the screen, Leo DiCaprio about the Sochan point guard experiment all season long. I think like a lot of people in the league were kind of upset about it from this like affront towards Wembanyama's development standpoint, and like the complaints about, man, can the San Antonio Spurs just put one person out there who can get this guy the fucking ball, has been a thing. And look, when the national TV lights are bright, it's just kind of a bit of a reminder that the Spurs haven't exactly found a laundry list of winners. And by winners, I mean, like, you can look down this and say that was a win of a choice in the first round, to where, I mean, Blake Wesley, 0 points. Sochan, I think, is like the biggest question mark because they took him ninth. And if there is no jump shot, if he is not a point guard, it is a little bit precarious as to like where he will net out as an NBA player at this stage of his career. You know, the Trey Jones increase of playing time with Wembanyama, I think, has definitely served Victor well. There's definitely chatter on the league, and there has been since the summer, about whether or not the Spurs will ever look to go get a point guard, whether that's a veteran or like a young guy like Emmanuel Quickley, for example. When his stuff came up short in extension talks with the Knicks in the fall, not saying that the Spurs were like guaranteed to be a suitor, but there was one team that teams were kind of linking as a potential threat for New York to not resign him, which, you know, but those are kind of things that go into the calculus of a Knicks team trading Emmanuel Quickley for OG Anunoby, which we'll get into trade stuff later. Is there still a burning desire from you, Dan, to like juice up whatever Wembanyama lineups are with more added table setting? Or are you just getting drunk on Victor Wembanyama going up against Giannis?
Why not both? Put those hands together, my man. I think this is what we've established, is that they are going to be able to put together like a top tier defense with Victor Wembanyama in the middle. Like with the more recent, you know, the injury to Zach Collins, moving him to the five, letting him roam, and, you know, like we've seen versions of it where he's the weak side, you know, stash him in the corner. He comes over like Time Lord blocking shots. And now we're seeing him as the centerpiece of the defense. They're going to be able to build a good defense around Victor Wembanyama sooner rather than later, in all likelihood. It's about what you can put around him offensively. And I think it was telling in, you know, reading through some stuff recently, Pop recently referred to Victor Wembanyama and Devin Vassell as, quote, our two skilled players. And now I don't know exactly what the emphasis was that he put on those words. I didn't hear the audio. I just read it. But it's like, yeah, you're going to need more than two if you want to build an offense. And, you know, Devin Vassell lights out last night, 34 points, 6-9 from three. Fun note, his second 30-point game in the last like month, and he had never had one before that. So like Devin Vassell kind of, you know, things may be picking up for him. But yeah, you need more. You need more hits. They're going to have a ton of bites at the apple in the draft coming up. They're going to have a ton of financial flexibility with which to try to find more pieces to put around them. I think the idea is, if you believe in Sochan as a, you know, battery and guy who will go out and guard the other team's best defender, and he can move the ball, maybe he's not a point guard, but maybe you expand his skill set to where he's a ball mover and a top flight defensive guy and a rebounder. That plus Vassell plus Wembanyama gets you like most of the way to a respectable starting five, but the other ones have to be shooters and passers. And so like where they find them in the draft or free agency or in trade remains to be seen. Probably not a coincidence also that Wembanyama had the big game and the offense kind of opened up for the Spurs. Trey Jones got his first start of the season last night. Malachi Branham was out of the lineup, so Trey Jones had to go into the starting lineup and had, I think, 18 points and a handful of assists. Like more fluidity will open things up more. But I think anyone concerned that the Spurs' first 25 games of experimentation is going to hamper the development of Victor Wembanyama should go back and watch some more of Victor Wembanyama playing through those first 25, 26 games. He seems to be doing all right.
Is Milwaukee doing all right? They've lost four times to Indiana this year. They barely escaped this game. The defense has been up and down, and the questions about Adrian Griffin's tinkering with rotations and schemes and all that have kind of been there from the get-go to, you know, not putting Brook in drop to rotation patterns and other things. So I don't know. I mean, the offense is obviously there. Christmas Day, when Griffin was speaking to the media before their loss to the Knicks, he was saying they were really starting to figure themselves out and kind of understand the chemistry that was needed amongst this group on both sides. And since then, like, they haven't exactly been world beaters. I am looking at Milwaukee right now because as I've been on the phone all week talking with teams about trade stuff, I mean, the ultimate goal for any midseason transaction for a team that's buying, which most of this league is trying to do that right now, it's with the benchmark of, can you beat the teams at the top of your conference? And right now, it does seem like Boston might just be a whole nother rung above Milwaukee when we entered this season thinking that it was going to be Milwaukee and Boston and then everybody else.
Yeah, you're absolutely right to point to the defense. I mean, there's multiple things can be true about it. Like, they're I think 22nd in defensive efficiency almost halfway into the season. It's just not good enough. That includes like some really bad defense at the start of the season, like after those first handful of games when you started seeing more and more from Brook and drop. They're about like league average in points allowed per possession, which with the offense they've got might be fine. But as you noted, they are really susceptible to not just high. I mean, the Pacers put up points on everybody, but it's specifically the way that the moves that they've made and the decisions they've made with their roster have left them so susceptible at the point of attack. It's, you know, Damian Lillard is just not a great point of attack defender. He's capable of executing in a scheme, but he's not going to stop people. He's not going to stop the ball all that often. Malik Beasley is not going to stop the ball that often. He's going to get down in a stance and he's going to, like, you know, he's going to be active, but he's just not going to stop the ball that often. And there aren't a whole lot of guys on that roster who can do it. Like, Adrian Griffin has leaned a little bit more toward, all right, we're going to give Marshawn Beauchamp more minutes. We're going to see what we have with Andre Jackson Jr., second round pick rookie. You know, now they've got Pat Connaughton back in the mix, we're going to see what we can do there. They're going to try some more things, but they're also having like their pickup points are like almost at half court against the Spurs, who are terrible. And like what came into yesterday, I think 29th in offensive efficiency ahead of only the Grizzlies, who didn't have John Morant for the first 25 games of the season. And then the Spurs score like a top 10 offense against the Bucks because the Bucks are just basically giving them driving lanes at the basket. So like that can't continue to happen. And Giannis he's indicted as part of it, but he's also been kind of clear about it. He had a great quote the other night after they got their doors blown off by the Pacers, as you noted, talked to Eric Name at The Athletic. And the quote is, "I've been a part of a few teams that have been number one in defense, but at the end of the day, it's all about pride and effort. If you have no pride and you don't put no effort in it, you don't get no results." Says later, "I believe if we lock in as a team and figure out that we cannot let a team score 140 points on us and we're trying to score 142, you cannot be consistent that way. So we have to be able to guard." Like, he knows it. Adrian Griffin knows it. Everybody knows it. The question is, what can you do about it? And Adrian Griffin continues to seem to be of the mindset of like more aggression, higher, you know, pickup points, trying to create a little more havoc as opposed to being more conservative. That's going to serve us in good stead when we get into the playoffs. And maybe it's just, you know, get Jay Crowder back. Maybe it's, can you find, I don't know if they have any second round picks in the couch cushions that they can find out, grab out someplace to get themselves into a trade discussion. But like, it feels like the answers to what they need are not there right now. And I don't know where they get them.
The Golden State Warriors are searching for answers too. Draymond Green potentially on the return sometime soon, but dropped an 18-point lead with 6 minutes and 35 seconds left in the closing game of our TNT doubleheader last night at Chase Center to Nikola Jokic and the Denver Nuggets, where the big man hit a ridiculous bank 3-point shot off the dribble from a couple steps inside half court to finish with 34, 10, and 9. He's just unfathomably great, man. He just does the thing that is needed to be done to win games every single night. And still a joy to watch.
Yeah, I mean, you're used to seeing those shots in Warriors games pulling up from 40, but it's the little guy doing it. It's not the, guy who looks like a mountain came to life. Yeah, Jokic has missed five shots in the last four games, which is insane. He is very much in that MVP discussion yet again. Him, Joel Embiid, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Giannis, Luka Doncic.
We're going to talk MVP here. On the show, Dan. Come on.
This is the extent of it. We're putting it into little brackets. The fact that, I don't know. I mean, this is I guess you could have a glass half full, glass half empty view of this. Part of this could be that was an extraordinarily impressive run by the Nuggets, a team that like knows who they are and what they're trying to do and Michael Malone knows what buttons he can push and, you know, what he's going to get out of his starters, yada, yada, yada. That's a championship team with a championship close to a game, not getting rattled on the road, whatever. Or you can look at it and say, the Warriors just keep losing these really bad games. Like, mm-hmm. I think this is the fifth time they've blown an 18-point lead, which is pretty rocky. Yeah, there was like the 24-point lead against the Kings the last night of the group stage of the in-season tournament. 22-point lead to the Clippers in early December. A couple of big leads they blew to Oklahoma City before overtime losses. Now this, they've lost four of five. It feels like forever ago they were 5-1 to start the season. They're 11-17 since that. They're just kind of flailing. And obviously the Draymond suspension is a big part of that. Klay Thompson's up and down season is a big part of it. Steve Kerr seeming to not necessarily know who to play and when is a big part of that. You know, there's a lot to sort of still get figured out here. The thing that I keep coming back to, and it's a glaring one from last night. So we've got the discussion about like, is Moses Moody in the rotation or is he out of the rotation? Is he a piece that they care about? Is he a piece that they don't care about? That's there, you know, still up for discussion. But Kerr tried seven different lineups in the fourth quarter, seven different five-man units, and not a single one of them included Jonathan Kuminga, who didn't play for the last 18 minutes of this game, despite having been put up 16-4-4 through the first like 2.5 quarters and looking like one of the only guys on the Warriors who had the physicality and athleticism to kind of go toe-to-toe with that Denver front line. And he just didn't get back in the game. And part of it is, we were rolling really well. We had a great third quarter, 44 points. Andrew Wiggins was playing great, just kind of didn't get back to him in the flow. But then part of it is like, if you have like Steve Kerr is searching for answers and it seems like he kind of keeps opening up the wrong door and going like, oh, there's nothing behind there. And I mean, 16-18, you're in 11th in the West right now. Like you would know better than me. I don't know what the salvation is that's coming in the trade market. It feels like they've got to find their own answers in house. And again, you know, they seem to keep finding nothing behind the door when they open it. So I don't know. Yeah. It's Steph Curry said after the game, something that I thought was like kind of emphasized where they are in a pretty good way. You don't want to be in a position where you're having to explain your way out of bad losses, but that's just who we are right now. Yeah. It's not who they've been for most of the last decade, but it is who they are right now.
Yeah. Two things. I mean, on the Kerr stuff, we saw it in Manila during the World Cup. And it's kind of also been the undercurrent of the entire two timelines discussion that hasn't really bubbled to the surface, is that they've never really found consistent minutes or roles for any of the young guys. Like right now, Pods and TJD are playing plenty of minutes. I mean, Trace right. Jackson Davis was like in the closing lineup last night, but there's no track record or history in Golden State to suggest that both those guys are going to be in the rotation come tomorrow. You know what I mean? And that's a challenge that I think we're seeing in Los Angeles right now. We'll get to that in a second. Just to the trade stuff. Look, I think when Draymond went down, there was a lot of conversation in and around Golden State that like this was their period to evaluate Jonathan Kuminga and Andrew Wiggins as well, but primarily Jonathan Kuminga. And like those are the team's two pieces to go out and do something. Like, I don't think they're going to put those salaries together and go try and get Pascal Siakam, but like that's kind of what they really only have to do in terms of high impact, whatever. Like if they're going to try to go around the margins and maybe, you know, Moses Moody, to your point, like try to flip him into something, because he's shown enough that I'm sure other teams would like to try to take a gamble on him. I just don't know how they're getting like a real difference making piece if they're not sending a Wiggins Kuminga package out the door. I'm not saying that Golden State's ready to do that yet, but that's just the reality of what this roster looks like. And yeah. I was just going to say, with Kerr, like, it's just hard for any of those guys, I think, to be, I mean, it's the classic cliche trope of, like, be ready. If you're always staying ready, you don't have to get ready. But, like, right. It is, these are human beings at the end of the day. And, like, it is a challenge to, like, never know what exactly is expected of you, because you're never going to know when you're going to be called on.
Yeah, especially for a young guy, you know, where you're trying to establish yourself, you're trying to build something, you're trying to, you know, put yourself in position for the first big contract. And how do you do that if your role and opportunity and touches and whatever else continue to diminish, even as you produce and show what you're sort of, you try to execute what's asked of you when you get the opportunity? Like, it's, that's got to be a difficult thing to navigate. And now we've given some glass half empty for the Warriors, because coming off of another, you know, collapse, it's warranted. Glass half full, you know, we always try to operate with optimism and juice here on No Cap Room. They are 13 and 14 in clutch games, which is disappointing, but it also means that, like, they're pretty much every one of their games has been within two possessions late. You know, you flip a couple of those and then all of a sudden you're talking about like a 21 and 13 team. And that's, you know, things look a lot different. They've played the toughest schedule in the league so far, according to Dunks and Threes schedule analysis. And they've got the second easiest one the rest of the way, according to Tankathon. Draymond's apparently getting ready to get back. Steph is still Steph. And, you know, Klay has started to look a little bit more like himself. I think like 39 or 40% from three over the last 15, 20 games. As you mentioned, productive minutes from Pajemski and Trayce Jackson-Davis. Like, there's some stuff to feel good about. You would just love to get some consistent, you know, run off a few wins in a row where you actually have like a set rotation and guys in set roles and set expectations to give you something to kind of build off of moving forward. Cause right now it just feels like they're flailing.
Yeah. The Lakers are certainly flailing. They've lost 9 of 12 since their big momentous moment on the podium with Adam Silver in T-Mobile Arena. And the Athletic comes out yesterday, Thursday, with a report about, quote, growing disconnect between Darvin Ham and players, which I've definitely been hearing about behind the scenes, you know, dating back to Vegas. Like, I think Lakers fans and people around the team have been, it started with the questions about Austin Reeves' playing time, you know, where he was coming off the bench, and then they sent D'Angelo Russell to the bench. And LeBron hasn't wanted to play point guard since like 2017 with the Cleveland Cavaliers. So we're now 6 years later, LeBron's inching on the doorstep of 40. And the last lineup that Darvin used before the game where they lost again, and then this article came out, had LeBron and four power forwards. So it's something that, like, I mean, the Lakers are already a pressure cooker for a head coach. We saw it at the end of the Kobe Bryant tenure with all the Mike D'Antoni and Mike Brown and quick change over there. This regime, run by Rob Pelinka, let go of Frank Vogel the year after he took them to a championship. So when you look at Darvin Ham, who was in interviews forever, and it's kind of similar to Adrian Griffin, if he does, you know, when guys are knocking on the door of getting that head coaching job for a long time and don't get it, there's definitely some type of reason behind it at a certain point. And Darvin's main selling point when he was hired in LA was that he was going to be able to hold these stars accountable. That was the thing. They were looking for someone who'd be able to get on these superstars and what have you. And you've got AD and LeBron complaining about the minutes behind the scenes. You've got Darvin.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. We don't know which of the six sources in that story would have been who.
I'm saying they're complaining about it. Oh, it's not, they're talking about it on the record in the postgame locker about we got to figure out lineups and whatever. Meanwhile, Darvin, since Vegas, just continues to complain, or not complain, but I guess pinpoint their shortcomings on health. And look, not having Gabe Vincent, and I know from conversations that Ham was definitely a big fan of Gabe Vincent and like saw some of himself in Gabe Vincent and was expecting that to be a big piece of this puzzle. So not having him does hurt. And from an overall asset standpoint, and like to think about how the Lakers can get out of this mess, not having the player you signed to a 3-year mid-level hurts. But no one else in that team is making excuses for the health stuff besides the guy who's pulling all these strings with the rotation. And I mean, I think this is the tip of the iceberg of this guy being legitimately on the hot seat right now. There's just a lot of chatter from people around the organization that he's not the guy that's going to be able to get this thing over the hump. And now, look, they were able to overcome whatever it was, like a 2-10 start last season to make the Western Conference Finals. So he's proven the ability to right a ship and steer them out of stormy waters to some beautiful island somewhere else in the postseason picture. But like, the noise is very loud. There's a lot of people very frustrated, a lot of agents calling the front office frustrated about their guys not getting the right opportunities. And if you do want to look at potential trade scenarios, the strategy of like re-signing D'Angelo Russell to a theoretical tradable salary at $20 million, like, I'm not seeing and not hearing from my calls around the league a ton of interest in that trade chip coming back. I don't really know what the Lakers are going to be able to do to upgrade this team if they're not sending Austin Reeves out the door, which of course they don't want to do that. He's their third best player. So they're going to have to hope that the Bulls with Zach LaVine or somebody else, you know, DeJounte Murray gets connected there, but like, why would the Hawks move him for D'Angelo Russell, Rui Hachimura, and a first round pick? That's not exactly like anything close to the three unprotected picks that they gave up, or you know, right, the two unprotected and the swap, whatever exactly the particulars were. So I'm going to end my opening spiel by saying, are the Lakers f***ed, Dan?
I mean, I think they're closer to that than they are to the promised land. Like sometimes the best adjustment is everyone needs to play better. And I think you're right. They're like LeBron and AD and then kind of everybody else. Austin Reeves had a really rocky start to the season, has started to sort of pick it up. Like going to the bench seemed to give him more opportunity to kind of get into a rhythm. But now with that rhythm relocated, getting him back in the starting lineup, another playmaker and another shooter that can provide some more space for that offense would be a huge deal, because that's been the biggest thing, that they remain a top 10 caliber defense, really good in the half court. They just don't have enough shooting and scoring, which has been the issue going back two seasons, right? It was the issue before the Russ trade. It was the reason for the Russ trade, and it was less of an issue late last season, but it was the argument for, we get D'Angelo Russell, we get Malik Beasley, we elevate Austin Reeves, there's more guys who can shoot. And they get to the Western Conference Finals in part because, like, yes, some of those things worked. And Rui Hachimura all of a sudden becomes a stretch four. And, some of these things panned out. And then the question was, like, are you paying for that? And then it's not going to continue once you've paid for it. And so far, the answer looks like, D'Angelo Russell and Rui Hachimura, who were not the answer for, like, middling to bad teams for several years, are also not the answer for you. Austin Reeves maybe isn't ready to be an all-star right now. And, it's not necessarily a shock. Our guy Ben Rohrbach wrote kind of a corrective to the narrative a little bit, being like, we maybe shouldn't be surprised that this roster isn't that good. In fairness, people like me, and I know you, like, we talked about the Lakers winning the offseason by retaining their guys and adding depth and adding shooting and adding options. And it just has not looked like that so far this season. As you said, the last season's resurrection came from a blow up half the rotation trade because they had stuff to move to do it. They had the big Russ expiring salary. They had a draft pick to do it with. Like, there was things that they could make an argument for where somebody would want it. I don't know where that is now. This is like the downside risk of continuity is if the guys you're bringing back wind up not being that good, of what value is the continuity? And, maybe this is why Darvin Ham is shuffling through starting lineups like he's playing cards. Like, the only answers you've got are the ones in the locker room. And so far, they're not particularly enticing, and they're not resulting in consistent quality play. But then to that point, you say there's a million people that have their different sort of gripes and agendas, and that are sort of like the noise is always going to be loud around LeBron. The noise is always going to be loud around the Lakers. you put them together and it's cacophonous. And this is kind of the cost of doing business for both of those brands, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
You know, especially if you are not,
he's in the last couple of whoever knows how many years left of his career.
Yeah, everything becomes more pressure packed. And then, like, you multiply that by just the nature of competing in the NBA right now. And, like, if you are paying exorbitant amounts of money for the talent that you've got, and you're, like, you know, franchises are looking to, you know, your luxury tax money and, you know, whatever you're trying to, you know, concern yourself with in the financial aspect of it, like, every dollar you pay that isn't like return on investment on the court, you feel like it's a huge deal. So all of that, like everything about it just feels incredibly pressure packed in a way that like a 7-game win streak would really resolve. But given the nature of that offense and the nature of that rotation right now, it's hard to see that one coming anytime soon.
Yeah, these are the perils of locking yourself into teams with two and sometimes three supermax contracts. That's just what it is. And you know, I've been waiting and kind of evaluating the talk about and wanting to hear more, honestly, about how the new CBA kicking in next year is going to impact trade deadline stuff over the next 4 weeks. Started to hear a little bit this week, just the people, like I was on the phone with a GM yesterday who was saying, oh, I wonder how teams are going to react to this. There isn't right now like a clear idea of, okay, there's going to be some teams who are just selling off their long-term deals to, you know, Gordon Hayward, for example, is a name that will be talked about plenty between now and February 8th because he's an expiring salary, but he's a big number that maybe the Hornets would be willing to take back future money to help another team. And it could be a little symbiosis there for some type. I'm not saying Gordon Hayward to the Lakers, although he's definitely a name I would keep an eye on just for who's available and the slim pickings there. There's not many sellers right now, as we've kind of been alluding to over the last couple of weeks. But like Phoenix is definitely a team that keeps being mentioned to me. Like they're super active. They're calling. They're trying to find backup point guards. And the team on the other line is saying, what do you got to give us, man? Right. You know, the Celtics definitely would like to find a couple of other guys. And it sounds like in the front court behind Porzingis and Al Horford, as much as they love Luke Kornet, and like they're just limited salaries there. Like if you are going to want to go get someone of real value, like even, you know, Chris Boucher, for example, is someone I know the Celtics have liked for a while. He's at $11.7 million. You're going to have to give up someone good to go get someone good. The Clippers, you know, they have some wiggle room because they were smart about trying to figure out ways to get Mason Plumlee on a veteran minimum, Russell Westbrook on a veteran minimum. They already have those mid-tier salaries like Norm Powell and Terrence Mann, although I think as they've said all along, doesn't seem to be any real interest in moving on from Terrence Mann. So, and Norm Powell, you swap out those two guys, the James Harden, Paul George, Kawhi Leonard, Ivica Zubac, four-man lineup with either Terrence Mann and Norm Powell. Both those groups are like top 10 in net rating in the league. James Harden to Los Angeles has certainly worked out. But then you go down to Minnesota where like there's all these talks about, you know, if the ceiling doesn't really work out this year, will they be able to afford Cat and Ant and Gobert and Jaden McDaniels' salary kicks in? And then you're going to have to re-sign Mike Conley next year, who by all accounts has been like a godsend for that team after being the other team involved in the Lakers, Utah, Russell Westbrook, three-team deal that we talked about earlier. It's just, it's going to get increasingly harder for teams to figure out ways out or like adjusting these big money plans when you make them. And I do wonder how many teams are going to start thinking about those concession opportunities or pivot points when they're putting together their rosters on paper, because it was always easy to be like, all right, let me look at Brooklyn. As bad as they are right now, you can put together three guys and you can send out 4 years of draft capital for James Harden. You can get it right back for Kevin Durant. Like, I don't know how seamless that type of life cycle changing is going to continue to be when the penalties with the second tax apron are going to be so stringent.
So this is, you know, it's a larger conversation about the like incentives or the ideas and the incentives behind instituting that more punitive second apron and the harsher luxury tax penalties, and why a league would want to make it more difficult to aggregate superstar talents in those ways. And I think one of the, it's sort of like the quiet, or maybe not even that quiet, but one of the like sort of driving thrusts of Adam Silver's commissionership is like David Stern would make jokes about like his ideal finals being Lakers versus Lakers. And Adam Silver seems to want the NBA to be a little bit more like the NFL or English soccer. And where it's, I mean, I guess English soccer is not a great example because that's like the three teams that spend more than anybody else. And then everybody else is fighting for fourth, but, or whatever the actual numbers are. I'm sorry. I'm idiot American. But the, like the goal is like as many teams as possible, having as good a chance as possible as winning something and competing late into the season and maintaining fan interest and playing competitive basketball into the end of the season. Hence the play-in tournament, hence the in-season tournament, hence mechanisms making it harder for teams to put like three, $45 or $50 million players together without strip mining the rest of the roster. And maybe that winds up being a net positive for the competitive balance in the league. I mean, there's an argument to be made that like for people like us, at least, like there's someone worth watching on every team every night, basically, because there's more talent than ever and there's more talent dispersed than ever. There's an argument to be made that like fans tend to like watching, when more casual fans especially, tend to like watching excellence, either be to root for it or root against it. Super teams being, you know, an eyeball draw for ratings. And, you know, there's a reason that people would want to read more about the superstar players that we write, and we write about them more often and we talk about them more often, et cetera. I don't know if it's going to wind up being a net good, like for the way the league operates and for the way that it, and, you know, stokes interest and the way that the discourse and discussion around it goes. But I know that there's never going to be, you're never going to stamp out a team being like, "F it, let's go for it." And like that, there's a no risk it, no biscuit kind of approach to all this. Like a guy like, God, what's the name of the new Suns owner? Not
Matt Ishbia.
A guy like Matt Ishbia.
He wants all
is
the
going,
biscuits. He's taking your Delta flights. He wants your Biscoff cookies. He's good. He's walking back from first class every row with his hand out saying, "Give me all your biscuits."
And I will give you a second round pick swap in six years to get your biscuit from you. I think I said sex biscuit and I shouldn't have said that. And I'm sorry, everybody.
I thought you were saying he was offering sex for second round picks, which I don't know if that's within the parameters of the CBA, but it might be legal.
There's nothing in the rule book that says you can't offer sex for a future second round pick. Bobby Marks, check us on that. All right. I know you're listening, brother. What I would say about, but like these people are going to go and say like, I have all this money. I have all this, you know, I am a competitive psychopath. And so I'm going to say, I want to win at all costs, and whatever it winds up being is whatever it winds up being. Or if you're the Lakers and you say, I have a chance to get LeBron James, and that means we have a chance to get Anthony Davis. And in 5 years, we'll deal with whatever downside comes with that. Oh, well, that's the, like, this is the high cost of living, is you might die. And like the Clippers, again, yeah, the Clippers mattered, quote unquote, during Lob City. They had a chance to matter even more than that. And it was Kawhi Leonard. That gets you Paul George, and that gets you in the conversation. And then 5 years of disappointment. And now they're back in that conversation again because they're playing great because they got Harden back. Like the richest guy in the league is not going to like, I mean, I'm sure he will care at some point about how much it costs him in luxury tax penalties or the mechanisms that are going to restrict his ability to add more talent to the team and Steve Ballmer. But like these guys are just going to keep going for it. There's going to be some people that want to keep going for it. And so super teams may, the way that they look and the way that they're constructed may wind up being different, and the way you get to them might wind up being different, but stack as much talent as humanly possible and pay what it costs to get it is not going to wind up falling out of fashion. It just maybe might mutate.
Yeah, especially it seems like the guys who come in to run these teams now, Ishbia, everything I've heard about the new tandem between Rick Chennault and Gabe Plock and Charlotte is like this is a role that these new owners are like preparing to do. They're not just like coming in wanting to hand the keys over to their executive and go away. They want to be involved. They want to be swinging for the fences. So it's going to be interesting to see how, again, all this stuff ends up revealing itself, maybe preemptively before February 8th. The first big trade of the window, of course, came Saturday morning. as I was TMI on the toilet after my Friday night out. I got my first text tipping me, hey, Knicks are up to something. I was trying to get it out there. Was not trying to get multiple things out. And
my God.
We found out it was OG Anunoby for quickly and RJ Barrett. OG's been as advertised. I just want to say this is a space I just want to give a take, Dan, because there's all this talk. We're both here in New York. You are a curmudgeonly Knicks fan that the Knicks aren't done. They saved all their first round picks. They still have Evan Fournier star. It's all true. They're going to be involved in the DeJounte Murray talks. They could get back an old friend like Alec Burks. There's plenty of point guards out there for the taking if they want to open up some, not even point guard, just some type of ball handler guy who can help relieve Jalen Brunson. That being said, here's the take. You only really need a backup floor general distributor dude for like 10 minutes in the regular season, and you only need it for like four come the playoff time, because Jalen Brunson's probably playing 44 minutes at a minimum. And look, if we're talking about the Knicks going out and getting more pieces to actually do something in the Eastern Conference, what's really the point of going out and spending two picks on someone like DeJounte? Or even what's the point come the summer if things do go to a head for someone like Donovan Mitchell to go out and splurge there? Where to me, the Knicks have been so patient. They've done a pretty good job, objectively, a pretty good job of building a strong 7-8 man rotation that can be really plucky in the playoffs and be there year after year after year. Jalen Brunson's an all-star this season. He will be an all-star. I don't care if he's sixth in starter voting, just based off of how he's been revered amongst league personnel. I'd be shocked if he doesn't get in on the coach's boat. So to me, if you've been New York and you were holding your powder dry for so long, and part of why you didn't go all in for Donovan was because you thought, and this is what I was told at the time from New York people, because you thought he wasn't going to be enough to then not have to go out and get another guy, right? Then like, what's the point of trading any of that stuff for anyone who's not named Giannis or Joel Embiid or, you know, those types of players? That's my take. Because if you really look at the picks, there's some thought around the league that like, okay, well, they got to move their 2024 and 2025 first rounders like immediately because they're about to be, you know, conveyed. But I mean, the Dallas pick is coming. Detroit's pick could continue to kick down the road. Washington's pick could continue to kick down the road. I just don't see like the real rush that some people do for them to actually cash those chips in right now. And I would rather be left holding a pick or two than have spent them on someone who's got, you know, a $30 million salary on my books that I'm then going to want to move a couple years later, like Atlanta is in the position with DeJounte Murray right now. That's my take, Dan. I'm curious if you disagree, agree, or have any other thought.
I was talking with our guy, Ben Rohrbach. I mentioned him earlier, about the Knicks and about the deal and kind of like where I netted out after it. Also, ruthless plug, talked about it with Blake Murphy of Sportsnet on Divine Intervention earlier this week. So you can listen to an hour long discussion about that there. My initial thought was like, I feel like it kind of doesn't change their life dramatically. Like they improved their starting lineup and weakened their bench, and they're probably like a maybe second round team, which is what I thought they were before. And then I kind of took a step back from that and was like, for most of the last 20, 25 years, that would have been like a result to kill for a Knicks fan and for the Knicks franchise, like second round, incredible. And so like, I think you're right. I think deciding to like, if you had a legitimate shot at one of those top five caliber players, then of course, yes, go all in for that kind of guy. But if the kind of guy you have access to is maybe more like a, maybe like top 20-ish player. And I don't mean any disrespect to Donovan Mitchell or Karl Anthony Towns or whoever else by saying that, like, it's really hard to get up higher than that. And the Knicks, as currently constituted, don't have one of those guys. They've got like two top 30-ish guys in Randall and Brunson. And so like, maybe you can argue that getting another guy in that sort of realm, the just like overall aspect of the, now there's several of those guys, and so that elevates you even higher. But like, the last thing they need is the hardest thing to get. And so you don't want to run out of you know, options that would might allow you to get that down the line. That said, I don't know who that guy is going to be. It's like, you know, you're not getting SGA out of Oklahoma City. You're not getting the guys that I just mentioned out of their current states. As long as those teams continue to be like championship caliber, I'm not sure who winds up in that situation. So I can see a middle path where they say, like, I don't know, like, I don't know what Jordan Clarkson's number is, but like, if I don't know Jordan Clarkson's number, but I mean salary number. Like, if you could say, like, is there a pick that goes to Utah and you take on that salary? I could kind of see that. Something where it's like bench scoring shot creation, which is what went out the door with Quickly, but that you don't necessarily have to marry to for 4 years and at a high number. I can see that kind of move. Maybe not, like, someone mentioned Colin Sexton. I think that contract is probably too big, but like, you can see a guy like that maybe being another middle path sort of move. But I think the more overwhelming likelihood is be pretty good and see where that nets out at after the season. Like, it feels not true, because I've seen the Knicks lose some games to very good teams, and also some like be maddening in certain contexts. But like, most of the numbers say, like the advanced numbers and adjusted net rating for based on your strength of schedule and yada, 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 say that they're like maybe the fifth best team in the East, the fourth best team in the East ballpark. That's probably about what they were going to be able to do no matter what. So I think that's just like, maybe appreciate that that's a pretty good outcome, and continue to sort of build and keep your powder dry, and then see if you can get into a series where, you know, Randall actually plays up to his level in the series, and Brunson is the kind of guy he was throughout the playoff run last year. You know, maybe you wind up in a different set of conversations with OG in the mix there, because they finally have the guy to guard the guys in the other teams. And so, you know, see what that nets out at.
The Toronto Raptors, the Atlanta Hawks, the Sacramento Kings, and the Indiana Pacers are the teams right now that most front office people I've spoken with are kind of repeating over and over again. That's going to be that, I guess, if you're listening to this, my story will have come out before this podcast has come out. So that is the theme of my latest trade notebook that came out on Yahoo Sports today, Friday, January 5th. I think the Hawks right now, the most interesting thing, they were a team, if we go to the Toronto post OG Anunoby dominoes, the Hawks were the team for Pascal this summer. They were, by all very various accounts, like, inches away from getting that ball over the goal line, if you will, with DeAndre Hunter being involved, with DeJounte Murray being involved. You know, who knows exactly what packages got so far, but those were the players and the pieces and whatever. I think Atlanta's doing the exact opposite right now, more so than going out to be a buyer. Right now, it sounds like the Hawks are truly considering the idea of being a real seller, taking a step back, and maybe even getting a couple extra lottery balls this year before next year's pick goes unprotected to San Antonio, to the point where the Hawks have told multiple teams that only Trae Young and Jalen Johnson are untouchable in Atlanta. If you haven't watched a lot of Atlanta lately, like I know Dan Devine hasn't, sorry to call you out.
No, it's okay. I was going to raise my hand and be honest about it. I haven't seen a ton of them recently. I know that they've been disappointing, but I haven't seen up specifics.
The team's been disappointing. Jalen Johnson being out for, I think it was 6 weeks, due to injury, played a large factor in that. He comes back and they blew the doors off of OKC on Wednesday night. The dude truly looks like a combination of like second year Blake Griffin and second year Ben Simmons with a 3-point shot. Like, I don't know how legitimate the shooting is going to be over a large sample size, but he looks fluid and comfortable with it. He is a legitimate ball handler. There was one play the other night where he like froze someone with a Thunder with a behind the back dribble in transition, just yammed on the whole defense. He's like running out and ripping steals and throwing lobs to Sadiq Bey. Like, the dude is unbelievable in terms of like what he's doing right now. The Hawks are really bullish that he could be a real linchpin, like number two banana with Trey. So everyone's on the table in Atlanta outside of those two guys right now. That's my understanding. The thing that's more interesting from like the flip side of a team that's like actually good that is trying to do things is Sacramento, where they haven't been paying attention. Kevin Huerter has now gone to the bench. He's not in Mike Brown's good graces at the moment. Not to say Mike Brown despises Kevin Herter, but you know what I'm saying. Chris Duarte's in the starting lineup right now, which is a interesting, more defensive-minded fit. He's only really playing a couple of minutes when he's in there, but that's neither here nor there. It's really all about Malik Monk's explosion and continued progression into being like a legitimate starting level player in this league. And I'm wondering what the Kings can ultimately do, because there was all this talk about, oh, could they go after Kyle Kuzma or Jeremy Grant or Draymond Green this past summer? And the Kings just did nothing. They just paid their guys and re-upped and moved forward. We're now, I've heard from multiple teams, they're calling around trying to see what a Kevin Herter, Harrison Barnes package could get them in Northern California, which is roughly $35-ish million, I believe. Maybe it's closer to 32 off the top of my head. But that gets you in the conversation for Pascal and potentially Jeremy Grant and other guys, where they were right in the mix for OG. Indy and Sacramento. Indy a little bit more, from my understanding. They were in at the end. So I'm wondering, Dan, is there a type of player, an archetype, or even a specific one that you think is the missing piece for the Sacramento group to really take that one step further in the Western Conference?
Yeah, the name that I went right away to, because I you know, added those numbers up and you're like, yeah, that's like 32.7, around 33 million. It's like that and a pick gets you into the Pascal conversation. And when I was talking with Blake Murphy of Sportsnet earlier this week, he had said like he thinks that the kind of package that the Raptors would be looking for, based on what they did in the OG deal that brings back brings back Emmanuel Quickley, brings back RJ Barrett, they're probably less likely to say we want the 3 draft pick trade, and more like we want the couple of rotation players trade, because we are trying to figure out what fits around Scotty Barnes as we move forward. And like, you can see Kevin Herter as a, you know, a shooter, a guy that's a volume shooter around Scotty Barnes as they try to continue to add space to the floor there. A guy who's, you know, been in playoff series and been in big games. Harrison Barnes, obviously great vet, respected around the league. Another, you know, stretch four kind of guy that could maybe create more space around Scotty Barnes. So that whether that package would be of interest, I have no idea, you know. And then also, I think probably would depend on when the pick would come and what level of protection and whatever, all the stuff that gets negotiated down, if those player types would be of interest and those specific players would be of interest for Toronto too. But Siakam, yeah, we talked this summer, I think the Kings were one of my like most interesting teams entering free agency, because that was my question. Like, where do we find the Aaron Gordon for Domantas Sabonis' Jokic?
And Keegan Murray's Michael Porter Jr.
Right, for sure. And so like there's an argument to be made. Like, I think we had talked about Jeremy Grant being that guy. You know, you bring him back up again. Maybe there's another bite at the apple in terms of the trade there. But like, where is the guy who is the big four, who can defend a bunch of different positions and is a playmaker, but doesn't necessarily need to dominate the ball to have a big impact? You know, can shoot, but it's more of a, you know, put the ball on the ground playmaker and somebody that can cover your back defensively. I don't know that Siakam's a 1-to-1 perfect fit for that, but I like it a hell of a lot more than a lot of other options. And, you know, that feels like it feels like something that makes some sense if we're trying to connect dots between buyers and sellers and, you know, who's out there. But obviously a lot of that would depend on just, you know, Toronto finally deciding that they are actually going to go all the way with making these moves, which it sounds like, you know, they're more open to it. Obviously, the Anunoby deal suggests that they're more open to it than they've been. It's still another big step for them, and they've got to get back the return that they're looking for. But I can see the framework of that discussion making some sense on both sides of it.
I definitely agree with the notion that the Raptors are looking more for pieces than picks right now. Definitely as evidenced by that deal. And further evidenced by the fact that they turned down multiple offers of multiple first-round picks for OG at last year's trade deadline during the summer. And I think there's a chance that Pascal Siakam would still be open to signing an extension there if trade deadline comes around and the Raptors decide that that's their best course of action. They're undefeated since the trade, 2-0. Who's to say?
Break them up.
But I think, yes, I woke up to a text this morning from someone saying, you know, I think the Raptors are more motivated than ever to move Pascal, which I definitely think is the case. And the last team that everyone's talking about is Indiana, even though they've got Obi Toppin and lottery pick Jairus Walker and Isaiah Jackson and Jalen Smith. They are still, by all accounts, super committed and curious about pretty much every starting power forward possible that they could bring into this group. I know they really wanted OG. I don't know the sticking points. I was trying to find it. I heard packages and offers that I was never able to get confirmed. We do know that Buddy Hield is on the block after he turned down extension numbers from Indiana in the fall. And I do know so far Indiana has pretty much rebuffed any team's interest in TJ McConnell. That's not to say that Toronto would want him back.
Untouchable.
That's another, I mean, a lot of teams would love to get TJ McConnell. He's arguably the best backup point guard in the league on a great salary, and teams just keep being told by the Pacers, no, you stay away from our TJ. You cannot have our TJ. So I don't know what the Pacers are going to end up doing, but I just am going to continue telling the people to keep your eye out on Indiana, the host of the All-Star game, to do something here to try to move this ceiling closer to a real legitimate playoff team, which it seems like is their goal, with Tyrese Haliburton becoming a true star and Rick Carlisle pulling the strings on the sidelines.
Well, yeah, they're a half game out of fourth in the East, right? Like it looked like this is actually one of the things that is most damaging to the Lakers case is like everyone's like, oh, well, you know, the post in season tournament dip, like everybody's, you know, the Pacers are really hurt. And then like the Pacers actually have won five straight now. But the way that they've done it, and you mentioned Buddy Hield being somebody that's on the block. Also, it just sort of feels like Buddy Hield is perpetually on the block constantly. Yeah. Everywhere he has been and will ever go, he will be on the block because everybody wants shooting, but they also want a little more other stuff. And yeah. Buddy has never really been able to do that. But he goes to the bench because they decide, you know, the Pacers at a certain point, Rick Carlisle was like, maybe we try a different group of guys as we continue to get busted up every single night defensively. And so Buddy Hield goes to the bench, Ben Mathurin goes to the bench, Obi Toppin goes to the bench, in come the closest thing that they have to more defensive minded personnel, which is Andrew Nembhard, Aaron Nesmith, and Jalen Smith rather, at the power forward spot next to Miles Turner. And like, they're doing pretty well. They're, you know, five straight wins. They're allowing a little over 115 points per 100 possessions in that five game stretch, which was like league average. And like, Jesus, if the Pacers could be a league average defense, they might win 60 games with that offense. And so like there's a question of, I think they know that they're not going to be a defensive, like this is not going to be a legitimate defensive team without personnel upgrades, without getting another guy who can be, as you know, you mentioned Anunoby, but like somebody who guards the big wings, because Aaron Nesmith tries his ass off at it, but is 6'5". And there just isn't, you know, you're not going to be able to do that and rely on that consistently. So where they could look for that kind of player, I think it's hard to see. You know, Siakam is another name I know they've been connected to. He's not exactly that kind of guy, but, you know, it would fit into that, you know, where you're looking for an upgrade at power forward, makes some sense. But they are also in the sort of enviable position of being closer to the start of a rebuild than, you know, needing to be, you know, pushing for a title. And also being, I think, better than people realized right now. So they're in that sweet spot where it's like before the pressure of you got to go for it right now starts to mount, and you can afford to be opportunistic. So especially because, you know, you look at that, their books, and there's like that partial guarantee for or the team option for Bruce Brown for next year. So that's like, I think they would want to keep him around, but also he's out of the starting lineup now too, I think. So like there are some pieces that they could move with, and they've got some money that they could move around, but they don't have to, because I mean they're in the, you know, they're in the honeymoon period, because Tyrese Haliburton has been that transcendent and gotten everybody that energized, and so they're playing with house money a little bit.
Just one last thing, I wouldn't be so certain that the Pacers want to keep Bruce Brown around, just from the thought that super tradable contract with that team option.
Like, yes, absolutely.
No, I thought you had something else to say.
Nope, nothing else to say. Shutting my mouth.
That's all we've got for you today, then. Thanks to John Gennaro for doing all the things he does to make this show look and sound great. He also looks great.
He does.
Subscribe
he looks great.
To Ball Don't Lie on YouTube and whatever podcast platform you're currently listening on, and leave us a 5-star review. We thank you for listening. We'd appreciate it if you came back again next week for another episode of No Cap Room.